It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Yesterday, U.S. officials confirmed that a video showing the beheading of an American journalist, James Foley, by a member of ISIS was authentic. Coming up, we'll hear how the president has responded and what could be next.
Protests continue to unfold in Ferguson, Missouri, where the streets are lined with heavily armored police officers and at least for now, National Guard members. It's the result of the killing of a young, unarmed black man by a white police officer.
For some, the unrest in Missouri harkens back to clashes between the police and civil rights protesters of the 1960s. While there's a lot of attention paid to the relationship between African Americans and police departments around the country today, our next guest says there's a precedent for that in American history.
Jonathan Pollack is with us now. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and our resident Central Time historian. John, welcome back.
Hi, nice to be back.
Well, how far back do these types of conflicts go between police departments and people in cities, these riots that may have a racial component?
Well, if we're talking about African Americans in specific, then we're really looking at the era immediately after the Civil War. That as African Americans left plantations on which they had been enslaved and went to cities in search of work, there were all kinds of laws set up that sounded neutral enough, but were really designed to clamp down on the rights of African Americans and really channel them into an emerging prison system that leased people out to do essentially the same jobs they had done while enslaved. So as part of that, I mean, one of the things that kind of resonated with me as I read the news coming out of Ferguson this last week or so was the way that the law comes down to enforcement. That there are, you know, the law, so to get back to the end of the Civil War, to the 1860s and 1870s, the laws in question there were vagrancy laws that were passed. And as often the case, the law sounds logical enough. Maybe it's not a good idea to allow people to just hang out on the street with nothing to do. Maybe vagrancy is itself leads to criminal activity and so forth. But then right away, you have to ask the question, what's the definition of vagrancy? You know, if somebody's waiting in a park for somebody to come out of their office and they're going to go have something to eat, or if, you know, there are lots of reasons that people are not in constant motion in their comings and goings, at what point does pausing become vagrancy? Well, that's, you know, the call we leave to the police and so forth. We don't have elected officials out there doing that. They delegate that to people charged with policing. And vagrancy laws were almost entirely enforced against African Americans. That whites who were at liberty, who were between jobs, or even sleeping in public parks, didn't seem to get pulled in on vagrancy charges very often, where for African Americans, even who paused for short periods of time, they would be charged with vagrancy, brought in before a court, have trouble finding an attorney who'd take their case and so forth, and wind up railroaded to prison on charges of vagrancy. So I think that's an early precedent, and certainly we can go through lots more instances through the 19th and 20th century, where for me it always comes down to enforcement. When I teach about the law in my classes, you know, we tend to seize on laws as a way of structuring history because it seems neutral. It's like, oh, well, there's the law. It's right there in the book. It's not an idea. It's not a political platform. It's the law. It got passed. But then we always have to ask ourselves, how do the laws get enforced? Who gets caught? Who doesn't? What are the patterns in that? And also at the same time, we have to expect there's going to be some variation. You know, we can't have, you know, the idea of perfect enforcement is kind of scary. I know even for things as innocuous as lights at intersections, people will say, oh, well, that's a huge invasion. I can't believe that this city is going to have lights at intersections determining when people run a red light. And that's really unfair and so forth. Well, that's perfect enforcement. That doesn't leave it then in the hands of when there's a police officer out there or the police officer is figuring out who to pull over for running a light and not. And people bristle at that. So it's this fascinating conundrum that the law is flexible. And that can definitely work against people. And at the same time, perfect enforcement also has its drawbacks.
And you mentioned the Civil War era. To dig into that a little bit, when is the first, I guess, what's the first event that stands out in your mind as a time when civil unrest unfolded as a result of what might seem like unfair enforcement?
Oh, well, one of them would be even a little earlier. The New York draft riots are a big part of that. So in 1863, during the Civil War, Irish immigrants to the United States were being drafted or were being paid to enlist, were being paid to take someone else's place. And there was a great deal of resentment about this, that as earlier Irish immigrants had gone and fought the Civil War and found out, no, this is really a pretty horrible thing, they came to associate by 1863 and 1864. Also, the it was very clear that one of the major issues in the war was ending slavery and therefore civil rights. And so whites who were going off to fight this war kind of turned on blacks in their neighborhoods and said, wait, we don't want to be fighting this war for you. Well, at the same time, African-Americans had just won the right to actually enlist and fight. Blacks had been kind of fighting for this, and the U.S. military had kept them at arm's length and prevented them from doing so. So there were large numbers of black men of draftable age in their late teens and early 20s around, white men not as much, and so they turned on them. And I'd say that was kind of an issue of what seemed like selective enforcement, that whites were being forced to serve, blacks were not, and therefore white mobs were angry and burned down black-owned businesses, chased blacks in the street, attacked homes, and so forth. That's often, if we look more recently, if we jump forward 100 years, and we look at the conflicts of the 1960s, if we look at Detroit in 1967, if we look at Watts in Los Angeles, if we look at the long hot summers, or what people call them, of the 1960s, that there also it comes down to selective enforcement, that oftentimes the incident that seems to have sparked it after the, you know, after the destruction, after the National Guard was called in and left and people took time to kind of take inventory and take stock and figure what was going on. It came down to either an aggressive traffic stop or even the rumor of an aggressive traffic stop, that tensions around this idea of selective enforcement had become so great that people were receptive to sort of second and third hand stories that maybe overemphasized the details of what actually happened at a particular arrest. They were prepared to believe it, that nothing shocked them, that seemed entirely possible, and they were ready to believe the worst. So that's, again, why a lot of the commentators to go forward now to Ferguson, many of the commentators looking at it have talked about they've talked about the climate so much that some people are just saying, well, how do we just fix this problem and so forth? And the others just say, well, it's Ferguson is the surface. And there are lots of potential Fergusons out there. There are lots of cities where the same kind of selective enforcement goes on. And so the same kind of pressure builds up. And there's just the same information exchanged in among communities, that they see the police as an occupying presence, they're willing to believe the worst, and so when something happens, boom, it's the worst possible circumstance, and they're extremely angry about it, and there's, you know, the resolution of one case might or might not end up making a huge difference.
Well, one strand of this that analysts like David Brooks have been talking about is the problem of perhaps a lack of diversity in Ferguson's police force. The idea that there's a white police force enforcing an African-American community being an inherent setup for problems, is that a strand that goes back in history?
That definitely is, yeah. And there are several, and again, this is a live issue that's gone back and forth. So, for starters, when we look at policing, and for some reason I'm talking about the 19th century today, so okay, we'll go back there again. when we talk about the beginnings of metropolitan police departments in the U.S., so when we talk about the 19th century, police work was a niche. It was an economic niche like anything else. So when people moved to a city, they'd find people they knew who could get them a job doing something, whatever that was. And so in the case of African-Americans, by the time African-Americans started settling in cities in large numbers, there were very few blacks who had been in cities who had gotten on police forces. You know, of course, in the 19th century, there's no law whatsoever about hiring across to ensure an ethno-racially diverse police force. It's completely niche hiring. It's completely who you know gets you the job. So when we talk about African-Americans and urban history, it's pretty much a straight trajectory through the 19th century into like the 1970s, where black populations became, when we talk about African-American communities, they're increasingly urban communities. And so they're coming into cities where police departments are historically places where no blacks worked. Again, much of that was due to racist attitudes against blacks, belief that blacks were unfit for police work and so forth. And beyond that, the close networks within families, within ethnic groups and so forth, within neighborhoods that ensured that people who knew police officers became police officers. So that's one aspect of it. One thing that cities have done as they've diversified is they've passed laws that require police officers to live in the communities they police. There was a commentator I read who talked about that, who used, I think he's based in Platteville, and he talked about Platteville as a point. He's like, well, everybody lives in Platteville, and they know the police officers. And it's like, well, okay, a couple of things. Number one, if there's no requirement that police officers have to work there, then the community they police becomes where they go to do their job. They're not tied into it. They don't necessarily know, you know, who are the people who, you know, who glare at them but really are not going to, you know, be serious criminals, and who is going to look menacing and actually is. They're not going to have that kind of neighborhood knowledge that you get of, I mean, if you think about like the neighborhood you live in versus the neighborhoods you drive to get to work, there's a big difference. You know, you can drive past someplace every day and you can watch the construction go up. You can watch stores go in and out of business and so forth, but you don't really know the people there. You've never been inside that store. You've never been into that restaurant or bar. But the restaurants and bars in your neighborhood and the stores in your neighborhood, you totally know them. They know you. So as police officers, when they moved out of cities, this is kind of a big issue that came up. If they're never in the city, they don't know it. They're not connected to it. So they're residency laws. But then many police officers said, we don't want to live in the city. You know, this is something that's still being hashed out in Milwaukee currently. So it's not clear. One of the things I've been looking for and haven't found is, what's the story in Ferguson? Do police officers have to live there? That would kind of make a difference. And even in a big city, you know, St. Louis, Milwaukee, when we look at suburban areas also, cities are, if we look at them from like a 20,000-foot vantage point, they're very diverse. We can see lots of different populations there and so on. But when we're actually on a ground level, many American cities, and St. Louis is a prime example, are extremely segregated. So even if police officers lived, you know, had to live in Ferguson, chances are they weren't living in the neighborhood, the neighborhood's closer
where Michael Brown was,
the street that he was shot on, that was this one sort of largely black enclave in what otherwise is a fairly integrated city.
We're talking right now with Jonathan Pollock of Madison College about the difficult relationship between the police and African-Americans throughout U.S. history.
And you can join the conversation. Do you have thoughts or questions about race riots or other racially charged civil unrest and police violence in American history? What do you think it would take to smooth things out in the future? You can call in with your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Central Times resident historian John Pollock, looking at the history of race, police, and tension in American cities in the light of events in Ferguson, Missouri.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question or a comment about the history we're talking about? Why have we seen these problems repeatedly cycle through different generations, and how can we move past them? 800-642-1234 is our number. You can also send your email to talk@wpr.org.
In 1968, that was a year that saw many major urban riots in several cities across the country. What happened there?
Whoa. Wow. Okay, that's a big question.
Think many of them were tethered specifically to the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Well, I mean, I think the assassination of Martin Luther King is another example of something I referenced earlier very quickly, so I'll go back to mm-hmm. it, that in many cases, when we're talking about a big conflict in an urban area, there are things that are going on underneath the surface long before that. So in many cities that saw a great deal of destruction and anger after King was assassinated, there had been earlier incidences of police brutality in the city. There were areas where the police already, you know, as cities grew to the point that you could no longer police a big city like Detroit or Los Angeles or Chicago on foot, and police officers were stationed in cars. That made a big difference because, again, when you're driving around in a car, you don't interact with people as much. Mm-hmm. You don't really talk to people on the sidewalks unless you stop your car and get out and so forth. So there was a rising amount of hostility during that time. The policing strategies that came out in the 1960s, many of them talked about, started using more kind of military language, military analogies about surveying territory and so forth. And as a result, there were more aggressive encounters. There were more instances of police treating suspects in a brutal fashion. So in cities that saw uprisings after Martin Luther King was assassinated, I think that came in because King was always a force, and especially by the late 60s, For many people, the earlier semi-radical nature of his message was kind of gone, and King was sort of he was the old style. You know, he was it's nonviolent. We're going to put on a show of soul force. We're going to show that we have we are stronger than the people who are trying to oppress us, and we're not going to fight. And a lot of people found that kind of unsatisfactory and so forth. And King came across as one of the most moderate leaders by the time he was assassinated. But then he was assassinated. And so at that point, people were kind of saying, oh, come on, that guy of all people, that he was the one assassinated. You know, how deep is the racism in America in 1968? So very long way of getting around to that question, which, to be fair, it was a really big question.
I know it was. I'm sorry.
But that's where I think it came from.
Well, let's get our callers in on this right now. We've got Mikkel joining us in Eau Claire. Hi, Mikkel.
Hello. How are you guys today?
Doing well. What do you think?
Well, I'm thinking at this point, basically what I've experienced in my life is that racism has been put behind closed doors. And I've lived all over the country pretty much, and I've seen and witnessed a lot of white people expressing their racism towards African Americans. And overall, I think what's going on is it's become something that is cliche, that is not talked about, that is unwritten, that is unseen, and it still exists very prevalently. And it's not only throughout the South, in the West, in California, in the South, in Florida, in the East, in New York, but it's also in the Midwest and in the North. It's everywhere. And you talk about high-ranking officials, judges, police officers. They're all known to be racists in their own homes. And this is the truth.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience and your thoughts, Mikkel. What about that, Jonathan? As racism becomes a taboo topic more and more in society, it's obviously illegal. We have hate crimes for this sort of thing. Do people just continue to practice racism inside their homes?
I think Mikkel really nailed it. I think that comment was spot on. One of the things I find really fascinating, and it's been in the last few years, I've really thought about this quite a bit. It's the phrase, "I'm not racist." You know, like you've got the Sterling thing where he tells his girlfriend not to bring her black friends into a basketball arena of 20,000 people. And, you know, what's his response to that? I'm not racist, you know. So Mikkel is absolutely right that racism is hidden. I mean, granted, in things like the Sterling case and in Ferguson, the comments that are coming out of there. No, it's an open display, but people won't talk about it. And but at the same time, as the caller also pointed out, yes, absolutely, racism is still there. And in a lot of ways, I think that makes, when we talk about this kind of tension that's in the background, that's hard to identify, that's hard to pinpoint, but I think is definitely in the background of what we're seeing in Ferguson. When we talk about this tension and we ask ourselves, where does this tension come from? Well, tension always comes up when you hold things back. You know, whenever you have you're in a work situation where you dislike the people you work with for some reason, but you can't say anything about it, you hold that in your tense. And you don't despise them any less. You know, it's still, but it becomes an extremely tense situation. And when we talk about racism, no, it's not gone. It's still there. But people are not talking about it publicly. At the same time, if we say, oh, well, great, then everybody should just be like straight out racist and so forth. No, that would also be a terrible idea. As you pointed out, Veronica, we have laws against this and for good reason. But nonetheless, that tension is what we all have to cope with. And I think our last caller put it very well.
And there are some who allege that coming out of the Ferguson situation that we're creating a conversation about race that isn't there. And at the same time, we're seeing people compare what's happening in Ferguson with images of what was happening in the 1960s with the Civil Rights Act. Is that a fair comparison?
I would say second yes, first no. The images are really compelling. I think there's a lot of there's a lot of resonance there. I think a lot of those wounds have not healed. That in as much as people talked a few years ago about entering a post-racial phase in the United States, I'd say nope, that hasn't happened. And at the same time, I'm also, you know, and it's kind of part of a piece with the I'm not racist thing I talked about a minute ago. The idea that the way to solve racism is not to talk about it. I mean, I think this is, you know, it's an interesting idea as an educator, as somebody who likes to get people to try new things and learn new stuff. It's something that really goes against just kind of how I'm put together, that I'm kind of all about new experience. But that definitely is an idea that's out there that people say, well, we just should shut up about it and it'll go away. It would be an interesting social experiment to do. I mean, again, based on the caller's experiences, I don't think it would actually work. But yeah, that definitely is an idea that's out there.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Okay. Thanks for bringing me in again.
That was Jonathan Pollock, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and resident historian here at Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll learn about the life and career of Wisconsin native Frederick March.
First, U.S. officials confirmed yesterday that a video showing the beheading of an American journalist, James Foley, by a member of the militant group ISIS is authentic. In the video, Foley cites the United States' air campaign against ISIS as the reason for his beheading.
President Obama launched that campaign on August 8th, and he spoke to the nation yesterday about James Foley's murder. Here's what he had to say.
ISIL has no ideology of any value to human beings. Their ideology is bankrupt. And they may claim out of expediency that they are at war with the United States or the West, but the fact is they terrorize their neighbors and offer them nothing but an endless slavery to their empty vision and the collapse of any definition of civilized behavior.
He followed up with comments about the United States' response.
The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. When people harm Americans anywhere, we do what's necessary to see that justice is done. And we act against ISIL, standing alongside others.
Douglas Ollivant joins us now to talk about the United States' response to ISIL so far and what we can expect moving forward. He's a senior national security fellow with the New America Foundation and former director for Iraq at the National Security Council during both the Bush and Obama administrations. Douglas, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Veronica.
Well, how significant is the murder and the message behind ISIS's murder of U.S. journalist James Foley to the United States?
I don't think this really changes anything except a level of awareness. Certainly, no one that I know who follows ISIL was very shocked by this event. This is very much in their character, in their nature. This is a brutal group that, you know, we've seen does crucifixions, buried Yazidi children alive, was running slave markets, massacring people. So this really shouldn't surprise us. This is well within the range of how they operate. But I think this has struck home with the American people in a way that what happened to the Yazidis was a little more at the level of theory to a lot of people. This obviously hits very close to home.
And here in Wisconsin, Senator Ron Johnson is going to be holding town hall meetings in the state to raise awareness about ISIL and the threat that they pose to the United States. Is this appropriate at this time? Do we need to be concerned here in America about the threat of ISIL maybe on the homeland?
Regrettably, I think we do. As we've seen, if you watch the video or watch some excerpt of the video, this is a brutal group. I mean, there are terrorist groups. You know, Hamas is a terrorist group, but Hamas doesn't bury people alive. They don't run slave markets. They don't massacre people, you know, as a group, as a people. They don't conduct genocide. This is a group of a different nature than your, you know, garden variety terrorist group, though those are still bad and evil and to be discouraged. So it's something of a different character, and they have a large number of Westerners. We estimate there are scores, around 100, give or take, Americans who are affiliated with ISIL, and as many as 1,000 Europeans, you know, who have passports where they can go through American customs without a visa, without much screening. So there's a very serious threat to our homeland. I think it's very clear that ISIL wants to be the big kid on the block when it comes to Islamic jihadism. They are clearly in competition with al-Qaeda. What distinguishes al-Qaeda from ISIS is that al-Qaeda has struck the American homeland and ISIL has not. I suspect that they want to change that.
So what do we do about it at this point? We've got airstrikes going on in Iraq, and that's something that could continue for the long term. But in terms of keeping out threats to America who may have passports, American citizens, how do we do that?
Well, that's going to require a lot of cooperation. It's going to require intelligence services in each of these countries to be a little more vigilant about their people who are going to known access points to move into ISIL. You know, to get to Iraq or Syria, very few of these people are just going to fly in there. They're probably mostly going to go to Turkey and move across the border in Syria, or go into Jordan and move across the border. So we should be able to track those people who move there. We should be able to do the same with American citizens. But it's going to require a lot of vigilance and a lot of intelligence sharing between all these countries.
And do you think the president responded appropriately, given the fact that, as you said, this did touch a nerve for the American public for good reason? Did the president do what he can to assuage fears?
I think the president is doing a remarkably good job managing this crisis. You know, there's obviously nothing we can do for Mr. Foley now. I don't think there's anything we can do for his companion either. I mean, they're in the hands of ISIL, and I don't think we have any idea where in the deserts of Syria or Iraq these people might be. So all we can do now is prevent further harm, or try to prevent further harm. And I think the president is also trying to raise awareness among the American people that this is a very real threat. And even though this threat is largely in Iraq, which all of us would like to never have any military engagement with again, nonetheless, there is this terrorist safe haven growing in Iraq that is a threat to our homeland, and we may have to do something about it.
Well, as you say, there's no appetite for a very intense involvement in Iraq, and yet this is where ISIL, where ISIS has taken root for a large part in Syria as well. So in terms of the U.S. response, what have the airstrikes accomplished so far?
Well, what they've accomplished so far is they've prevented ISIS from spreading further. They've not been able to move towards Erbil. They've not been able to move towards Baghdad. And when they took the Mosul Dam, we were able to push them off of that. I think that what we saw in the Mosul Dam operation may have been a proof of concept for how we want to do this in the future. We saw Iraqi government forces in conjunction with Kurdish forces fighting on the ground against ISIS or ISIL or Daesh or the Islamic State. Those are all equivalent terms. With U.S. air power in providing support. And with the U.S. air power, both the Iraqi army units and the Kurds did substantially better than they had done in the past against the Islamic State or ISIS. I think that's our proof of concept moving forward. Now, a lot of the other places that the Islamic State may have to be engaged, the cities like Mosul and Tikrit, are going to be much harder than was Mosul Dam. You know, there were no civilians around Mosul Dam. There were no buildings to hide in. It was hard for them to dig in there. So that was a relatively easy place for us to expel the Islamic State from. But I think that still showed that that's the preferred technique that we're going to want to have moving forward, like we did in Mosul Dam or something on the Libya model, where the Iraqis or other forces, you know, we've had the PKK has been helping. That's a Kurdish group in Turkey. That's actually a designated terrorist group, but they were part of the group that helped rescue the Yazidis, so we seem to be okay with that. Perhaps forces out of Syria. I think it'll be whoever's willing to help us fight on the ground against ISIS or ISIL, we may be willing to help provide air power for.
And President Obama has said that ISIS is a cancer that he'd like to see the world rid of. Is there any plan on the table to do that, to eradicate ISIS, or are we just sort of controlling damage right now?
Well, we're certainly controlling damage right now, and I think we need to be aware that this is something we're going to have to live with. Now, we don't have to live with them controlling large pieces of territory in Iraq and Syria, and I think that's something the president is going to engage the American people about fixing. But, you know, this cancer is not going away anytime soon. There are deep root causes that eventually we'll have to worry about. We're not in root causes mode right now. Right now we're in dealing with these terrorists who slaughter people and run slave markets and behead journalists, and that's appropriate. Once we get to the point where they're pushed back, then we can start thinking about root causes in the region.
Douglas, do you expect to see more involvement from the U.S. in terms of military might, more than airstrikes?
I think the president is going to be remarkably reticent to put U.S. forces on the ground in Iraq for all types of very obvious historical reasons. That's just still an open wound in the American body politic. We still have not resolved what we think as a whole about the war in Iraq, and we still fight about it a lot. So it's hard for me to see him committing ground troops in any serious way. You know, advisors at Embassy Baghdad, advisors at some of these senior military headquarters, you know, where their chances of getting overrun or captured are very, very close to zero. Yes, something like that. Putting American troops into combat, probably not.
We'll leave it there, Douglas. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Veronica.
That was Douglas Ollivant, Senior National Security Fellow with the New America Foundation and former Director for Iraq at the National Security Council during both the Bush and the Obama administrations.
Only one actor has won both the Academy Award and the Tony Award twice. It was Frederick March, who was born in Racine on August 31st, 1897.
March attended UW-Madison and went on to star in major films from the 30s through the 60s. He won an Oscar for his title roles in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
How is Frederick March remembered today? We'll find out from Jim Healy. He's the director of the film programming for the UW-Madison Film Coalition Cinematheque. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a little bit of Frederick March 101. Who was he?
Well, he was born Frederick Bickel in Racine, and I think he was one of the great, you know, great actors of the first 30, 40 years or so of sound cinema, certainly regarded as one of the great actors of the theater, too, although we don't have too many records of his theatrical performances today. We can certainly see his film work. He was a classic leading man, but he had a kind of extra layer of tenderness and vulnerability that came through, whether he was playing fathers or authoritarian figures or even villains in some cases.
And somewhere along the way, he went from Bickel to March. Is that his Hollywood name? Did he become Frederick March instead of
Bickel? No, it was something he took as a stage name. He was acting in the theater mainly during the 1920s, and he changed his name at that time. I guess, and you can imagine why.
it's a little more, you know.
It reminded too many people of Pickle, I think. So.
I see. Well, let's talk a little bit about his connection to the UW-Madison. How did he end up here?
Well, he didn't come here right out of high school. He worked for 2 years in Racine as a banker, and he wound up here in Madison just after he turned 19, I think, and started school in 1916, rather. He was born in 1897, and studied commerce here as a continuation of his work as a banker. But soon he joined a drama society and had a little vaudeville act going with a friend. And eventually he was cast as a lead in the Edmond Rostand play, The Romancers, here. And he caught the theater bug here at the University of Wisconsin.
And what was his first big break?
Well, there's a couple, I think. I think for the big role that got him into movies was a play he did on Broadway by Moss Hart and Edna Ferber called The Royal Family. And it was a thinly veiled depiction of the Barrymore family, Ethel Barrymore and John Barrymore, who were the best known actors of the time. It was a comedy. And in the play, March played a character based on John Barrymore. And it was very popular. Eventually went on tour, went to Hollywood, where it was seen by all sorts of casting agents and studio personnel. And he got a contract at Paramount Pictures just at the dawn of the sound era, signed at Paramount and did, I think, something like a dozen films in his first 2 years under contract at Paramount, one of which was the film adaptation of The Royal Family. So that was a big break, but I think the film that kind of launched him into international stardom was his 1933 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, directed by the great and innovative filmmaker Ruben Mamoulian. And in the film, March plays both parts, of course. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde went through an elaborate kind of makeup process, but he was compelling in both roles. And it was a big hit at a time when horror films were big box office here in the U.S. and all over the world, Frankenstein, Dracula, and the like, and it became a big smash, and it won him his first Academy Award for Best Actor.
All right, so what won him his second?
That was for The Best Years of Our Lives, which is one of the quintessential films of the 1940s, if not of all time. William Wyler film from 1946, a really beloved film. I'm sure most people know it, about returning war veterans after World War II. And he plays one of three main characters in the film, three returning vets. And his is the least, I'd say, the least showy part. He plays the older senior member of the three veterans. And it's a part with, you know, a lot of sensitivity and understanding and compassion. And I think it just, you know, really moved a lot of people, as did the film. One of his co-stars, who played one of the other soldiers, Harold Russell, who was a real-life disabled veteran after the war, won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar that year.
You mentioned the broad array of parts that he could play, the types of characteristics he could convey on screen, and I imagine that came to his advantage during Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Where did he hone his skills as an actor?
That's hard to say. I think he was a big fan of film and theater. He went to see a lot of plays and movies throughout his life. He was a big disciple of John Barrymore. He really admired him a lot, who had played Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in the 20s. Being a good Midwesterner that made him a kind of everyman. You know, he was a very handsome guy, but at the same time, he could play, you know, someone very distorted, like Mr. Hyde. You know?
Well, turning to his career on Broadway, he turned down, apparently, the part of Willie Loman in the original Broadway production of Death of a Salesman. Why?
That's right. He had been very busy. This was 1949, and he just came off making three movies in a row, all co-starring his wife, Florence Eldridge, who was an accomplished actress herself. The last film he had done of the three was an international production, Christopher Columbus, which took him to Europe, and he came back to the States, and he just felt he was too tired to accept such a demanding role. He was thrilled to be asked, and he recognized what a great and potential role it was, but he turned it down and later said he regretted it. But eventually, when they made a movie of it in 1951, he accepted that and was nominated for another Academy Award for playing Willie Loman in the screen version.
And we hear actors today who have done some television and film and then go on to do Broadway that the two are so different. Was that true back in Frederick March's day? And was he as big a success on Broadway as he was in films?
I think he was as big a success. He had, you know, his ups and downs. He could do three or four plays in a row, just as he could do three or four movies in a row that would be failures, that would not draw an audience. But then he could do something like, made the very first portrayal of James Tyrone Sr. in the very first production ever of Long Day's Journey Into Night, which he played for, I think he performed in for well over a year. And this is a 4-hour play and exhausting and grueling. And I think it's because of this that he found theater to be much more tiring than movie work.
When you look at his career, he in the 30s was acting with some of the biggest stars there were, Gary Cooper, Greta Garbo, Olivia de Havilland. And yet, I don't often hear his name mentioned in their company. Do you think that time has forgotten him, or is he still remembered as he should be?
I hope not. Some of the films are certainly wonderful and should be viewed, and I'm sure some of them still are. His Jean Valjean and Les Miserables is tremendous. It's the 1935 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and well into the 40s and the 50s and even the 60s, too. He's in some terrific films like Executive Suite, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, Inherit the Wind, and a terrific mid-60s Western called Hombre with Paul Newman. And then he capped his film career. In fact, I think it was the last role he ever performed as Harry Hope in the film version of The Iceman Cometh in 1974 with Robert Ryan and Lee Marvin.
Well, in our last moments here, if there's one film we should check out that that stars Frederick March, what would you recommend?
Oh, that's so hard. Well, we didn't talk about comedies, and he did a handful of comedies that were really terrific. And just last night, I watched Nothing Sacred again, which is a screwball comedy where he played opposite Carol Lombard. And it's on Netflix, and it's 73 minutes, and it goes by like a breeze, and it's extremely funny.
All right, I recommend it. We'll check it out. Thank you, Jim, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Healy is the Director of Film Programming for Cinematheque, a coalition of UW-Madison departments dedicated to finding and showing important films that would otherwise not be available.